strangely enough, it's sort of very modest win-win for both sides. It kind of fits where they are tactically at the moment.
The Phase 1 trade agreement between the U.S. and China is scheduled to be signed today in Washington. This is Wednesday, January 15th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also coming your way, the Trump White House is now facing a start day for the U.S. president's impeachment trial. A younger population, this means big changes for Cambodia. And dangerous smoke from Australian fires is circling the globe. All on today's VOA Asia. China's economy czar is in Washington for the signing of an interim trade deal. Vice Premier Liu He, Beijing's chief envoy in talks with Washington over their tariff war, had been expected to attend the signing, but the Commerce Ministry's statement was the first official confirmation. Washington postponed planned tariff increases following the announcement of the Phase 1 deal in October, but earlier punitive duties imposed by both sides on billions of dollars of each other's goods stayed in place, dampening global trade and threatening to chill economic growth. Under this Phase 1 deal, Beijing agreed to buy more American farm goods, and Washington's chief negotiator, Robert Lighthizer, said it would make changes to respond to complaints about its industrial policies. Details have yet to be announced, and Chinese officials have yet to confirm any regulatory changes or the size of purchases of American soybeans and other exports. There are reports that those details could remain secret. Joining us on VOA Asia is Ed Alden, and he is with the Council of Foreign Relations.
The biggest piece that's missing is anything that tackles the issue of Chinese industrial subsidies. So the Chinese government funds a huge amount of money into a variety of sectors, steel, glass, shipbuilding, and particularly emerging high technology sectors. It's a problem for the United States. This is a problem for the world. The Phase 1 agreement is entirely quiet on it. It's also not clear what the Chinese commitments are going to mean with respect to technology transfer. China forces a lot of companies, foreign companies that are investing in China, to share their technologies as the price of doing business in China. This has been a thorn for the United States for a long time. Not clear that the deal will say anything new on that at all. So I think those are the big outstanding issues.
Is there anything, or do you hear of anything coming that might move forward, or is this just going to delay everything?
Well, I think, you know, there are elements here. The Chinese have made purchase commitments of some sort, so I think that'll be good for U.S. farmers, certainly better than getting hit with more tariffs on their exports to China. So I think that'll move forward. There are things going on outside the trade talks having primarily to do with competition in high technology goods between the United States and China. And we're seeing a lot of signs that the U.S. and China are each going their own way when it comes to things like 5G and next generation semiconductors and biotechnology and issues like that. I think we're going to continue to see that played out over the year. I think the era of very deep economic integration between the United States and China is over. I think this deal will, as I say, call a halt to some of the conflict, but it's not going to change the trajectory of the relationship, which is now moving in the direction of less rather than more economic integration.
What does this deal, as you understand it, do to countries that are not the United States and are not China?
Well, it will mostly hurt them because the purchase commitments the Chinese are making, or at least according to the U.S. Position at the moment, so large that it's going to require diversions. I mean, China's going to have to buy, you know, fewer soybeans, less pork from places like Canada and Australia and others in order to meet the purchase commitments it's making to U.S. farmers. So there are already rumblings of other countries being angry about this. The benefits for other countries, I suppose, are, you know, there's some additional opening of investment into the Chinese market, particularly in financial services. China has reiterated commitments to strengthen intellectual property protection. Those will help companies from other countries as well, not just American companies.
Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He specializes in U.S. economic competitiveness, trade, and immigration policy. Ed, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Ira. Thank you.
You're listening to VOA Asia. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. The U.S. imposes sanctions over North Korean workers abroad. South Korea pushes for cooperation with the North despite rejection and insults. In Indonesia, the UAE Crown Prince will lead the new capital construction. Taiwan elections belie the notion of Asian values, says an analyst. And the United States no longer is branding China a currency manipulator. Read and watch more on VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues now. The U.S. House is set to vote Wednesday to send the articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump to the Senate, and pressure was mounting Tuesday on senators to call fresh witnesses for the historic trial. Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the next steps after meeting privately with House Democrats at the Capitol, ending her blockade Tuesday, a month after they voted to impeach Trump on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The president and the senators will be held accountable, Pelosi said in a statement. The American people deserve the truth, and the Constitution demands a trial. The Constitution does that. The action will launch the Senate proceeding, only the third presidential impeachment trial in American history, coming amid the backdrop of a politically divided nation and an election year. The trial should determine whether President Trump should be removed from office. So far, the U.S. president has borrowed from the playbooks of two of his predecessors, who faced threats of being removed from office. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara has more on that.
In facing the threat of impeachment, President Donald Trump has followed a defense tactic similar to that of former President Bill Clinton and his team.
They really focused on, well, the president is doing work, he's going overseas, he's doing the work of the people, and he's not distracted by this, but at the same time spoke with one voice saying this is trying to overturn the will of the people. They're trying to overturn an election.
He has also adopted tactics used by Republican Richard Nixon, who stonewalled congressional requests to access the tapes of Oval Office conversations that incriminated him in the Watergate scandal.
He tried to cooperate at various times, releasing select transcripts and all the rest of this stuff. But he tried to also make the claim that this would compromise national security, and it had to come down to a Supreme Court decision that really led to the opening of the tapes and the smoking gun tape.
In 1974, the Democratic-controlled House Judiciary Committee passed three articles of impeachment against Nixon for obstruction of justice, abuse of power, and obstruction of Congress.
Article 1 is adopted.
For Trump, two articles for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Not a single Republican representative voted to impeach Trump. The process was less partisan during Presidents Clinton and Nixon. Dozens of opposition Republicans voted against impeaching Clinton, while senators of Nixon's own Republican Party pressured him to resign before he could be impeached. And there is another big difference this time.
Richard Nixon, the problem he had is everything there were massive crises during the time he was being impeached, particularly inflation, unemployment, the economic issues in the country were quite severe. And I think that damaged the sense that things were unraveling economically, damaged his potential support among the larger public.
Out of 44 presidents before Trump, three have faced impeachment. Both Andrew Johnson in 1868 and Bill Clinton in 1999 were acquitted by the Senate after being impeached while Nixon resigned. Whether or not Trump survives a Senate trial, impeachment is a black mark on any president. So far, the political parties of an American president who has faced impeachment have lost the White House in the next election. Trump will test the streak in November. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
The U.S. president was impeached by the Democratic-led House last month on charges of abuse of power over pushing Ukraine to investigate Democratic rival Joe Biden as he withheld aid from the country and obstructing Congress's ensuing probe. Happening now in Asia, China's state media report an enormous sinkhole opened on a city street in the provincial capital of Xining. The gaping depression swallowed a bus and pedestrians and sparked an explosion, killing six people and leaving 10 more missing. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. With two-thirds of its population under the age of 30, Cambodia is undergoing a generational shift that is challenging the nation's social and political status quo. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Phnom Penh that with no memory of the Khmer Rouge's bloody rule in the 1970s or the long years of civil war, many young people today are less worried about upheaval than their elders and more willing to advocate for greater freedom and change.
Cambodian women's rights activist Catherine Harry is breaking social taboos in her country by discussing issues like sexual consent, harassment, and safe sex during her video blogs on social media. Her feminist message, while not overtly political, does urge women to stand up for their rights in this traditional male-dominated culture.
In a way, I'm questioning the power. I'm questioning the power balance, the dynamic, and I want more representatives in the government. And right now, it's not. There's no equal representatives.
Harry is part of Cambodia's baby boom generation, the largest population of young people in Southeast Asia. With no memory of past atrocities committed decades ago and engaged in the wider world through social media, many are becoming advocates for social and political causes. In the port city of Sihanoukville that is undergoing rapid economic expansion, environmental activist Thun Ratha is working to preserve the city's old trees and cleaning up waste and pollution as part of a campaign to put ecological limits on development. A member of a group called Mother Nature Cambodia, Ratha's sometimes confrontational approach towards authorities worries his parents, he says.
I think my parents or uncle's generation, who had gone through the Khmer Rouge regime, are very afraid of issues related to politics, environmental protection, and respect of human rights.
Prime Minister Hun Sen has cracked down on dissent in recent years as young people are increasingly calling for political change. In 2016, a student was jailed for 18 months for calling for a color revolution protest movement on Facebook. In 2017, the main opposition leader, Sam Rainsy, fled the country under threat of arrest, and his Cambodian National Rescue Party was forced to disband, effectively making Cambodia a one-party state. Despite the increased danger of speaking out, young activists say they will continue to advocate for social and political justice.
My whole life as a woman growing up in a conservative country, I've always been oppressed. And yet, I have internalized and I've been conditioned into thinking that all of that oppression is okay, and I don't want other women to go through that. I don't want young women to grow up thinking that it's okay to be treated as second-class citizens.
And Harry and others say it is only a matter of time before the old social and political order gives way to the new majority. Brian Padden, VOA News, Phnom Penh.
Coming up, you'll learn why there are fewer mega weddings in India. You're in tune with VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia, more than 30,000 people near the Philippine capital of Manila have evacuated from the immediate vicinity of a volcano that has been spewing lava, ash, and steam since Sunday. Government work was suspended and schools closed. The eruption has not directly caused death or major damage. This is VOA Asia. This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Dozens of workers toil coating thin lengths of bamboo in herbs, spices, and richly colored powders to create incense sticks that are spread out under the rising sun to dry. It's an important time of the year for the villagers of Yangchun County, a mountainous area of southeastern Fujian province that supplies much of the world's incense. Yangchun County is now home to around 300 manufacturers, according to Chinese media, employing more than 30,000 people. Locals claim that one in every three incense sticks sold in Southeast Asia is made in Yangchun.
Now, we're mainly producing incense used for paying respects to Buddha, and the demand is very high. Earlier, we were working on the Chinese market, and now also we're working on the Southeast Asian market.
Now the clock is ticking with the approach of the Lunar New Year holiday later this month, when countless Chinese will pray and burn incense at temples and in traditional ceremonies.
Many processes are simplified as much as possible and replaced by machines. After all, the demand is increasing. We have to develop machines in all respects to replace manual operation.
Demand is growing in China and in Southeast Asian countries like Malaysia and Indonesia that have prominent overseas Chinese communities, as well as in Buddhist Thailand. Weddings in India are famously lavish, lasting days and with hundreds, if not thousands, of guests. But this season, many families are cutting costs, even if it risks their social standing. It is symptomatic of a sharp slowdown in the world's fifth largest economy, with Indians spending less on everything from daily essentials to once-in-a-lifetime celebrations. Chartered accountant Palak Panchamia, for example, has already slashed the budget for her upcoming Mumbai nuptials by a third, trimming spending on clothing and the guest list.
Considering the market scenario right now, there is a little recession in India as well going on. So considering this starting phase, we've consciously tried to cut down on the cost by effectively 20-30%.
Cracks emerged in 2016 when the Indian wedding season, which runs from September to the middle of January, was hit by the government's shock withdrawal of vast amounts of banknotes from circulation in a bid to crack down on undeclared earnings. Hopes for a recovery proved short-lived when the cash ban was followed by a botched rollout of a nationwide goods and services tax in 2017 that saw many small-scale businesses close. I'm Ira Melman with Business Scene. Here's a news break from VOA Asia. The United States has imposed sanctions on two North Korean entities for facilitating the export of labor in violation of UN sanctions. Human rights groups have often accused North Korea of sending its citizens to foreign countries for forced labor to sustain its economy. Remember to visit VOA Asia on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. Now on VOA Asia, smoke from fires in Australia is expected to make at least one full circuit around the globe and then return to the skies over Australia, so say scientists from NASA. Using a fleet of satellites, the space agency has been analyzing the air and aerosols coming from the fires blazing there in Australia. At least 28 people have died nationwide, and in the state of New South Wales alone, more than 3,000 homes have been destroyed or damaged. State and federal authorities are struggling to contain the massive blazes. Scientists at the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory and several other institutions track dozens of them each year. But the sheer number and intensity of the recent fire clouds in Australia has many scientists saying this event may be one for the record books. I spoke with one of those scientist at the Naval Research Laboratory, meteorologist Michael Fromm.
What's going on is that back in the last days of 2019, in the early days of 2020, they had a cluster of these storms we call pyrocumulonimbus storms, and they are similar to a thunderstorm. They're also similar in some ways to a volcanic eruption. So if you can picture a volcanic eruption and how that injects material into the stratosphere, the pyro CB, which is what we say for short, acts like that in that it is so violent and energetic with updrafts that it can actually deposit smoke and any other gaseous pollutant from the fire directly into the lower stratosphere. Once it gets into the lower stratosphere, like a volcanic plume, it's got free rein to get blown around in those fast winds and last a long time because it's above normal weather.
So what has these current fires added to that?
These current fires have added a multi-day sequence of multiple pyro-CBs. We're still counting them to get the number right, but we've counted at least 20 and probably as many as 30 individual pyro-CB storms from a variety of these fires in New South Wales and in Victoria.
And what happens to these plumes? You, according to the report, it said that they are traveling around the Earth. Can you get into that a little bit?
Certainly. Again, because it's in the stratosphere and because there's a huge concentration of smoke particles, they can be transported by those fast stratospheric winds very efficiently, very rapidly. And at the wind speeds of that altitude, they can actually encircle the globe in about 2 to 3 weeks. And so the injection events were anywhere between the 30th of December and the 4th of January, and there were multiple ones of those, and that resultant plume has, in the subsequent days, been tracked all the way around the globe, roughly at the same latitudes as Australia itself, but generally an east-to-west movement from Australia across the Pacific, across South America, across the Atlantic, south of Africa, and across the Indian Ocean, and now back near Australia. Some of it is blowing back over the Australian area itself, and some of it to its south, and going back out over the Pacific Ocean as we speak.
Does this stand a chance of moving toward the equator in the northern hemisphere?
Indeed it does, and indeed it has. We just put out a little post to our scientific community yesterday indicating that that has happened. We have been able to observe the smoke and confirm it anywhere from the equator down to high Antarctic latitudes, as far south as 80 degrees. So it's going not only east to west, but it's also going north and south.
There is a volcano in the Philippines.
Yes.
Is that adding to this?
To be determined. Don't know yet. We're following that as well here at NRL. And I can say right now that it appears to have injected some material into the lower stratosphere, but it's too soon and the observations are too sparse to say for sure. We're trying to answer the question of what's going on, what is different. And I have to say, at this moment in time, I would still have to say I don't know. I know enough to know that what's happened, for instance, with the fires in Australia from their spring right till now has been very unusual. We've never seen anything quite like it before. But what I don't know is what are the conditions that have allowed that to happen, and how different are they? You know, fire often happens naturally by lightning strikes and things like that. But why these are so numerous and gotten so large must rely on factors that we haven't quantified yet. So I'm still in the I don't know phase, but very eager to learn phase.
That's meteorologist Michael Fromm of the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 1929, Edwin Hubble, astronomer and namesake of the famous space telescope, provided evidence that the universe was expanding. To determine the rate of expansion, Hubble came up with a unit of measurement called the Hubble constant. Initially, Hubble estimated the universe was expanding at a rate of 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec. A megaparsec is equal to about 3.26 million light years. Over the years, astronomers have lowered estimates of the Hubble constant down to between 50 and 100 kilometers per megaparsec. Astrophysicists from Clemson University recently used new techniques and data from the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope and the Imaging Atmospheric Cherenkov Telescopes to determine the Hubble constant. They estimate the universe is expanding at a rate of nearly 67.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Dan Crafton. I'm Ira Mellon in Washington. Have a wonderful day ahead.